Good afternoon. So happy to have all of you join us today. And I'm just delighted to welcome Shelley Archambeau to Bridgewater. Shelley is a leader and a pioneer with more than 30 years of experience in technology and in business. And she's one of the first female African-American CEOs in the Silicon Valley. And I know you're going to really enjoy today's time with her. She's had a career which in many ways embodies Bridgewater's values. She's shown resilience through her rise to the top, never forgotten the importance of mentoring and helping those around her to climb the ladder. She's a bold communicator. You'll find that she's very candid, which would make her a great fit for Bridgewater. She was CEO of the company MetroStream, which was a software company in the Silicon Valley. And under her leadership, it grew to a global market leader with, I guess, over 1,200 employees. And there's a Harvard Business School case study on it. Among other things, she's an author of a book titled Marketing That Works, How Entrepreneurial Marketing Can Add Sustainable Profits to Any Sized Company. But even more exciting, this coming Tuesday, right, Shelley? You have your next book, which has a fabulous title, Unapologetically Ambitious. So Shelley, thanks so much for being with us today. And I'm really delighted. As I mentioned to you, I'll start off with some questions and you and I can have a conversation. Then I'll open it up to our audience. And I hoped I might start with just a little bit of a walk through your career. And you know, how did it all start? And what inspired you to pursue the path that you did?
Oh goodness. So I am a bit unusual in that I actually decided I wanted to be a CEO when I was 16 years old. And the way that happened is I was having the conversation with my guidance counselor, the obligatory junior year conversation, which is, what do you want to do when you grow up, right? And I said, college. And she said, well, what do you want to do after college? And I said, honestly, I don't know. I just want a job where I can keep the thermostat at 72 degrees because my parents never let it go above 68. It could go below 68 in the winter, but never above 68. Anyway, and she said, well, what do you like to do? And I said, well, I love my clubs. You know, I'm in everything, National Honor Society and American Field Service and French Club. I'm a Girl Scout, and, you know, but I really like leading them. And she said, well, if you like leading clubs, that's kind of like business. You pull people together to a common objective, go and execute. And I said, done. I love running clubs. I'll run a business. And when I looked around, people who ran businesses were called CEOs. So I said, great, I'll be a CEO. So honestly, it was that naive and that audacious. But I'm goal oriented. So now I had a goal. Now I had to figure out how to go make it happen. So that took me to Wharton because it was the best undergraduate business school. And I figured if I did that, I didn't have to go to grad school. I'm sorry, are you muted?
Yeah, with Alan Bowser, no less.
That's Wharton, right.
Our own Bridgewater, that's how one of the ways that we got connected with you, Shelley.
Yeah, absolutely. Alan and I met our freshman year at Wharton. And it was great. It did what I wanted it to do. And I wanted to get into tech because tech was a growing industry. And IBM was the Apple, Google, Facebook right of its day. So I said, great, I'm going to join IBM and become CEO of IBM. So that's what I did. I joined IBM in sales, actually, which my friends thought was crazy because I'm coming out of Wharton, I'm going to sell computers. What the heck? But every single CEO at IBM, I'd done my homework. They started out in sales. So I figured that was the path to power, right? Find the current path to power. So I joined in sales and rose through the ranks 14 years. Got to the point where there wasn't anyone higher than me in the company. I was over in Japan running a multi-billion dollar division. My boss worked for Lou Gerstner, the CEO. But it wasn't clear that I was actually going to be CEO. So I said, all right, IBM is really what I wanted, but CEO is what I want the most. So I decided to work my way to Silicon Valley, long story short here. And ultimately, after being the chief marketing officer and EVP of sales at two newly public companies, I got hired to be the CEO of a very broken company called Zaplet, which I turned into MetroStream and indeed became a leader in its space over the course of about almost 15 years. And now I'm in my call it phase two. I serve on public boards like Verizon, Nordstrom, Okta, and Roper Technologies. I advise companies large and small, write a little bit, coach, and anyway, and try to drive passion projects. So that's a quick walk.
It's an incredible career. And, you know, I had a chance to take a quick look at your conversation with Black Enterprise on women in tech. And one of the things you talked about there was increasing your odds as a Black woman in the technology sector and breaking through lots of barriers. And I wondered if, tell us a little bit about that. What was that like? And if you sort of look through your journey and look at present day, how much have things changed and maybe how much have they stayed the same?
Yeah, great question. So it was very clear to me early on, David, that the odds weren't in my favor, right? When I looked up and said, I want to be CEO, I didn't see a soul that looked like me. So I figured if I did what everybody else does, it wasn't going to happen. So how do I improve my odds? And that's how I've approached everything. So I have a goal. I do the research. What does it take to get the goal? And then I ask myself, what has to be true for me to achieve it? And then I put a plan in place to make it true. And so it's goal, plan, execute. And a lot of people set goals and some people put plans in place. But very few people make decisions every day consistent with that plan. So by being intentional, that's how I really work to increase my odds. And, you know, that's everything from, you know, starting out in IBM. I'm like, great, brand new, shiny. I want to be CEO of IBM. And I look around and I'm like, oh my God, there's 120,000 people here. They probably all want to be CEO. How am I going to stand out, right? How am I going to break through? So it's figuring out how to create a skill set that will hopefully be value and set you ahead, right? In addition to just doing a good job, because hard work and ambition alone are not enough. You have to be strategic on how you think about these things. So anyway, I would tell you that being a female and then being a woman of color on top of it, yes, people always underestimated me. They didn't assume that I was actually ambitious and had goals and aspirations. So I definitely had to work harder just to be heard and to be seen for what it is that I offered. And that's, you know, that's been true all the way through. And frankly, I don't think it's changed. That part has changed that much yet. The good news is there are at least more examples out there. And because people now see a few more people who have done things like I've done, they at least can now imagine that. Before, yeah, they couldn't even imagine it.
Yeah. Now, I want to come back to some of those sort of broader societal issues, because I think it's obviously a moment where all of us are contemplating and reflecting and what's changed and what hasn't changed. Just another question on your career before we do that. I've got a theory of the case. And my theory of the case is that when you look at a very successful person like you, and behind the story, there's almost always a person or a couple persons that that helped, mentored along the way. And I wondered if that's true in your case. And if so, is there a story or a person you can share that you were going to zig, and instead of zigging, you zagged because of this person's influence?
Oh, interesting. I've been fortunate that I've had a lot of mentors and supporters along the way, which has been very, very helpful. In terms of zig versus zag, I'll be candid. My husband probably played the biggest role. He was definitely my biggest cheerleader, my biggest fan and biggest supporter. But leaving IBM, as I mentioned, was really hard. I mean, I was basically born at IBM. I started working for them when I was at Wharton and then joined them full time. And then, you know, I grew up in my professional life with them. So I felt like if you cut me, I bled IBM blue. But they weren't treating me right necessarily. And while I was disappointed, it was my husband who really helped open my eyes to say, Shelley, this is more than just disappointment, right? So I probably would have stayed a little longer at IBM. But he's the one who really helped me with that one. So that's one. Zig versus zag, I would say the other one would have been Bill Campbell was a big and
the Trillion Dollar Coach, right?
Yes, that's right. So that's right.
I want to hear about that. I read that book recently, and he sounds like he was a remarkable guy.
Oh, he really was. So Bill Campbell was someone. He was on the board of LoudCloud, which became Opsware, the Mark Andreessen Ben Horowitz company, and I was the chief marketing officer and EVP of sales. So I presented often to the board. I was at every board meeting, and I adopted Bill. So that's what I do. I adopt mentors. I never ask people. I just start treating them like it. Mm-hmm. So I adopted Bill, and frankly, I think he kind of adopted me right back. And Bill was great because he would give you the feedback you needed, but he was always there in terms of to support you, right, and help you go forward. So, you know, I would tell you, he's the one that really helped open the door. He introduced me to Kleiner Perkins, Vinod Khosla, who ended up hiring me to be CEO. Uh-huh. So he was definitely not just a mentor, but definitely a sponsor through that. And he was terrific. I mean, once I got my CEO job, I'd sit down with Bill once a quarter. And I did that for probably the first three years or so. And then I had created a group. I needed peers. This whole thing about becoming CEO, everybody tells you it's lonely. And you nod your head, you say, yeah, okay, it's lonely. But it's not until I got into the seat that I'm like, oh, what I really miss are the peers, the people that you can really talk to, right? So I created it. I just pulled together a group of other CEOs building businesses. And over time, Bill would meet with us as a group, right? And so he was just phenomenal, absolutely phenomenal, super supportive.
Yeah, we can talk all day about that because I was so taken by how impactful he had been to so many people. It was a very unlikely path. He was sort of a semi-successful football coach well into his 40s, and then all of a sudden had this remarkable run. You capture some of this, I'm guessing, in your book, your upcoming book. So I wanted to ask you about that. And, I know you never set out to be an author. And here we are, and you're about ready to launch. You can see it in the background there.
That's right.
Tell me about, and we're going to have lots of buyers here at Bridgewater. Tell me about the book. Why did you write it? Why at this point did you feel like you had a message that that you wanted to share?
Certainly. I have tried my entire career to be accessible. I actually respond. I respond to emails, LinkedIn's, et cetera. And it takes a ton of time. But I would do it because I wanted people to see that I'm a real person, right? I'm a real person. I'm here. You can touch me. So if you can do all that, then you can do what I've done, right? I'm not that special. I'm not this, so must be somebody special. But as I got more and more responsibility in my career, I could still respond and I still do, but I couldn't meet with everyone that wanted to meet with me and both hear the story, understand the strategy, right? What do I need to do, et cetera? And I said, you know what? When I get to phase two, I'm actually going to write it down. I'm going to write it down so I can share with others what people don't usually talk about in terms of these books, right? Most people, you say, well, how did you get to where you are? And they share the overview short story that I shared in the beginning. Oh, I took step one, step two, step three, ta-da, right? And so when other people start to struggle and it's hard, they're thinking, well, obviously I can't do it. This is just too hard. Well, no, it's hard for everyone. And I wanted to share the fact that, yes, it is hard for everyone. And there are trade-offs and there are choices that we have to make. And if you're intentional, you can work your way through it and improve it. And I wanted to share the strategies and approaches, even some hacks for how to really turn the odds into your favor. That's why I wrote the book, because I want more people to be able to achieve their aspirations and more people to be able to contribute to their full capability. Because so many people never do. And it's all that wasted talent. And it's like, no, you can do it, right? Let me just show you, let me give you some tools to help you, but you can do it. Because all these things, imposter syndrome, feeling like self-doubt and eating away, right? You think people who are successful, they don't have it? Yes, they do. I've had imposter syndrome, I still do. So I talk about it, right? But it's all those kinds of things. I just wanted to demystify, right, a little bit, and just give people encouragement as well as tools to improve their odds.
Well, I wanted to encourage everybody listening to put their questions in the chat room, and I'll try to draw them out. But while you're doing that, that imposter syndrome was something I wanted to ask you about, because I know that's something you highlighted in the book. And we've had a number of conversations recently at Bridgewater where that notion comes up of confidence and the belief that, you know, someone, or particularly earlier in their career, has something to say and having the courage to move forward on it. Talk a little bit about that. You know, it seems how that manifested itself in your career, and then the shocking reality that you said, which is here you are, you know, at the pinnacle of, you know, a remarkably successful career, and still feel this at some times.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. You know, studies show that most people, not everybody, but most people experience imposter syndrome at some point or another. And then for those listening, in case somebody doesn't know what that actually means, the whole imposter syndrome thing is that little voice in your head that says, you really don't know what you're doing, right? Or one day they're going to figure out that you're not as capable as they think you are. You know, it's that whole self-doubt thing that feeds in that makes you feel like somehow you're a fraud, right? You don't really belong. You shouldn't take that job. You shouldn't, because you aren't really good enough. That's what it is. Well, studies show that not only do most people have it, but women tend to experience it more than men, but women of color experience it the most. And so it's important to understand that most people experience it. So when it happens, realize it's not you. It's just this thing, right? It's this thing. We live in a very judgmental world. And I think that's part of why we have this thing called imposter syndrome. So if that doesn't work, right, then when people open the door and invite you in, a new job, join the group, right, participate at the table, they're doing it because they believe that you have good things to contribute. Well, believe them, right? Don't fight that. And if that still doesn't work, then fake it. That's what I've done my whole career. Fake it until you make it. Just act like you know what you're doing, because eventually you will. You always do. So get over that first step, right? And just play the part. But it's interesting. I see that imposter syndrome is definitely related to confidence, but courage I see as something different. And courage is something that I wish more people would work on, because nobody's born with courage. When you see somebody courageous out there, boy, they have so much courage. They were probably born that way. They weren't. Human beings were born to be scaredy cats because we can't protect ourselves. Mother Nature built in a very strong fear, right? Flight. That is the reaction that most people have. So if you want to overcome it, you actually have to work on it. Just like muscle building, right? You want to build muscles, you want to build strength. Well, you got to work at it. It's practice. Courage is the same thing. So when you feel uncomfortable, right? When you're like, oh, this isn't comfortable. It's okay. The best way you get comfortable is you just push through it. And you realize that, oh my God, I spoke up and I didn't die, right? So anyway.
Well, when we did our preparation call, you mentioned that your two superpowers were courage and discipline.
Right.
So talk about those, but talk about it in the context of you're not born with the courage and you need to go to the gym. Well, how do you go to the gym? How do you go to the gym in courage? How do you go to the gym in discipline? How did you develop those things as, you know, key attributes of your success?
Yeah, well, courage stemmed from not so great experiences, actually. Growing up, I grew up elementary school in the 60s. My family moved when I was in first grade, literally in the middle of first grade over Christmas, from Philadelphia to a suburb outside of Los Angeles, where for the first time, I was the only one that looked like me in my grade, if not the school. And this is the 60s. So civil rights stuff is going on. And for as many people that want civil rights, you have as many that don't. And so I learned very quickly, very harshly, that people didn't want me around. So, you know, I got beat up. I was tripped. It's just not good. So therefore, the courage thing, I had to develop, because no matter what happened the next day, I had to go back to school. The next day, I had to walk back into that classroom. So that I had to have. And so I learned that, all right, I don't feel good about it. I'm not comfortable. I'm definitely scared. But you know what? I did survive each time. And then as I got older, I learned that, you know what, if I was courageous, if I did step forward first, then it was actually a way to get other people to follow me. People like people who are courage. If you show courage and you're willing to step forward and step, then people like to actually follow those kind of people. So being courageous actually became something that helped me attract and build, if you will, relationships and friends. And so I said, fine, then I need to strengthen this. So strengthening it for me was raising my hand to ask questions, stupid things, right? But raising my hand to ask questions. It was volunteering for things when it came forward. It was, I always just leaned in to do things first. And over time, it just became comfortable. But all the way through. And then the discipline piece, I wasn't born with discipline either. So I use other people to help me maintain my discipline. Because although I'm not very disciplined by nature, I do have a lot of pride. And I work really hard to keep the commitments I make. So if I want to be disciplined about something, I just tell people. Part of the reason I tell people my goals is because then I have to do them. Because I'm not going to turn up and say, oh no, I didn't do it.
It puts you on the hook. Yeah.
Exactly. So use other people to help you hold you accountable if that's what you need.
When you step back and you look at your career, it looks like this. Everything looks like it's, you know, up and to the right. But my guess is there were some moments where things didn't play out perfectly. And I wondered, you know, we spend a lot of time here talking about mistakes and failure as an engine for self-improvement and learning and so forth. I wondered if you might share with us, a circumstance where things didn't work out so well, where you struggled, you had a failure of some sort, and how you worked your way through that and continued on your great career.
Absolutely. So, you know, Blockbuster. So I left IBM. And this is 1998 timeframe. I left IBM to go to Blockbuster. I thought it was actually the perfect opportunity. For those of you that may remember, Blockbuster at the time was a behemoth.
Is it so scary that only you and I probably know what Blockbuster is?
I was trying to be generous and say hopefully some people out there. But for those that
Alan knows, but Alan's older than both of us.
That's right. Blockbuster, you know, it was one of those things. That's where you rented movies. There was one on every corner. It was just the behemoth. And so Blockbuster was all about stores and retail, and they wanted to launch an online presence. And I was hired to be president of Blockbuster.com, which meant building this. And I'm thinking, fabulous, right? I'm building technology into the future, but off of a company that has this huge brand, this is going to be great. So I moved my family from Tokyo, which is where I happened to be with IBM, to Dallas, Texas to start this job. And in the beginning, all good. Get things going, get the site built, launched, et cetera. But honestly, like 8-9 months in, it becomes really clear that Blockbuster doesn't have the vision for the future. How did I know that? Because Reed Hastings then was the CEO of a fledgling startup called Netflix. And Reed and I got to know each other because we're in kind of that same space. They had technology, but no industry knowledge or relationships, et cetera. I had all the industry stuff and I'm trying to build technology. They came out, pitched to the CEO, let's take Blockbuster.com and Netflix, put them together, go conquer the world. And my boss said, if that ever turns into anything, we'll just buy it. Okay then. So here I am, thinking, well, all right, they obviously don't have the vision, but I've just moved my family. My daughter's just started high school, right? My son's in school and this isn't going to work. And I'm in Dallas. There's no other tech in Dallas, right? So this was kind of, So I need to find the right kind of opportunity to head towards my CEO job. And I figure I have to go to Silicon Valley. So huge issue, because I'm not going to rip my family up after 8 months and move someplace else. So it was short-sighted on my part. Maybe not so much, I don't know how much more I could have figured out with Blockbuster, but I should have thought about location in terms of just longer term of what's possible. So anyway, long story short, I paid the price. I commuted to Silicon Valley for 3 years. Wow. Until my daughter finished high school.
Wow. Yeah, that's tough. Mm-hmm. That's a tough lesson learned.
Absolutely.
Yeah, sort of along these lines, one of the Hillary Tanner is one of our women here at Bridgewater, and just asked the question in the chat room about rejection and whether at any point along your career there were moments where you were rejected, didn't get the job, were told that you weren't the right person for whatever you were aspiring to on your journey to CEO-ship. Did that ever happen? How did you process that? How did you rebound from it?
Yes. Yes is the answer. It did happen. I was actually going after my, I'll call it first executive job, and I didn't get it. But here's where sales, and honestly, I think everybody should spend a stint in sales, because here's where sales really helps. I'm actually not afraid of getting a no. I actually like getting no's. And the reason I like getting no's is they bring clarity, because you don't accept a no. By the way, no doesn't mean no forever. No just means not now. It means something's not right. So when you get the no, you get a chance to find out, well, what will make it right? So when I got the no on, hey, I think I'm ready, and they're like, no, not ready. Then it's like, okay, so what do I need to do to be ready? And then you get the roadmap, right? So whether it's, for me, it was an experience. And so fine, I went and got the experience, and then I got it the next time. So don't be afraid, and don't see it at all as rejection. So I didn't really see it as rejection. See it as a chance to learn what you actually need to do. And you get clarity. Much better to get the no than just wait and wait and wait, right? Mm-hmm. And it doesn't happen, and you don't know why it's not happening.
If it's okay with you, I wanted to shift gears a little bit and talk sure. about a much broader set of issues, which is some of the tumult happening in the country. And obviously it's been 2020 is a year that's posed lots of challenges. We're dealing with the pandemic. We're dealing with the economic downturn as a consequence of the income shock. And we're seeing all sorts of fractures in our society. You see that in the divisiveness and the rioting in the left and the right. And you also see it in terms of racial matters, really ignited by George Floyd's death, but all sorts of other compounding things that have led to that. And I wanted you to just maybe reflect on that for a minute. You made the point earlier, the 60s to now, sort of the point where we're at as a country. And the reason I want to ask you about that is the next question I'm going to ask you is how to think about that as a CEO, because I know that you've spent a lot of time thinking about the role of CEOs in terms of being leaders on broader social issues. And I thought you might share with our audience your reflections on both.
Certainly. So right now, you know, it's interesting. I am cautiously optimistic is how I describe how I'm feeling about right now, especially as it relates to the racial societal issues that are happening. Because frankly, even back in the 60s, when there was so much discussion around civil rights, businesses stayed on the sidelines for the most part, really leaving it to kind of government, right, and policy and things like that. But now what I'm seeing is businesses are actually getting engaged. So I see that as a real positive. The other thing that is positive is we're actually talking about race. You know, race was one of those topics that it was so taboo, it wasn't even listed as one of the taboo topics, right? You don't talk about religion, don't talk about politics, don't talk about sex. We had a list, but race wasn't even on there. So that's how taboo it was. But now for the first time, we're actually talking about it. Now, is it comfortable? No, right? But that's not a surprise. But at least we're starting to talk about it. So people are at least hearing about experiences that they had no idea were actually going on. And I'm hoping that that overall awareness will at least build a level of not just empathy, but then also action. And frankly, I think that's one of the reasons why businesses are actually getting engaged this time, is because they're realizing, hey, wait a minute. Yes, we care about our employees. And we've always focused on our employees as it relates to the business, right? And business time. But if our employees are not feeling safe, or if our employees are not able to, you know, live effectively, or not able to, then we need to participate, right? And trying to figure out how to help that too. And I actually think that's a very good sign, because businesses have more power than they realize, especially on a local level where you operate, right? Have so much power. And frankly, I don't think we use, as business people, I don't think we use all the power that we have to actually impact some of the social, you know, change or improvement that is required. But I am seeing that power starting to be used.
And you see this playing out, this debate playing out in lots of different ways. But one of the areas that's been interesting to me is the debate around sort of stakeholder capitalism. And I'm sure you saw the statement that the Business Roundtable put mm-hmm. out, I don't know, six or 12 months ago or something. And then there's been some recent executives in Silicon Valley that have sort of made the case, the alternative case of shareholder profit-driven leadership versus broader stakeholder leadership. What are your thoughts on that debate? How did you think about that as a CEO? How do you think about it now as a member of some very significant boards across the country?
Yeah, I am very supportive of the philosophy and the stake in the ground that the Business Roundtable made. I do believe that companies and corporations indeed have a responsibility, yes, to shareholders, but also to employees, to customers, and to their community. Because if you think about it, what shareholders want are sustainable returns, right? And if you really want to have sustainable terms, then, or returns, then you have to make sure that not only what you're doing, but where you're operating, how you're operating, all those things are able to continue. And if you're really just focused on just what shareholders get and not the community in which you operate and not the customer set that you have, et cetera, none of that, well, over time, your shareholder returns are going to be challenged if all of the rest of that actually declines. So I think it is the same answer, frankly. I think it's just the timeline that you look at. Over time, all of that needs to work. And, you know, we have lots of examples of that absolutely being the case. So, yeah, I believe it's the full responsibility.
And is that way of thinking becoming very much a central to, you know, the boardrooms and the CEO suites you're in? Is that more more the norm than the outlier, or are we still in some transition?
Now, on the boardrooms that I serve on, the companies that I advise, it is absolutely now it is the norm. And I chair two nominating governance committees, right? And it's within the governance committees that typically all of that falls in terms of what are we doing with regards to ESG, right? All of that falls into kind of the community on that. And yes, it is front and center and part of the strategy. So no, it's not off to the side. It's absolutely down the middle. And I'm very encouraged by it. I think everyone wins in the long term.
Great. I'm looking at the audience questions here, and there's some questions that go back to your career a bit and your CEO-ship. So if you don't mind, I'll go back to that. And then I've got some questions about technology and how that's changing the world. But Emily had a set of questions around your point about increasing your odds as a woman of color in the executive space and tech space. But just extrapolate that on that a bit, if you would, about what specific things can women do in particular to increase the odds, and how do you think Bridgewater and other companies can help women do that? What can the individual do, but then what can the company where they are part of, what can that company do?
Sure. So individually, what women can do is, back to my point about being intentional, let people know what you want. Let people know what you're aspiring to so they can actually help you. Studies show, and a matter of fact, I was looking, this is tech, so I'm not sure if it translates to finance, but given that both tend to be male dominated, I bet you it does. But a recent study that I saw for tech, it asked, women in tech, what was keeping them from getting to, you know, senior executive levels? And it asked men, what's keeping women from getting to senior executive levels? And only one item on both were the same. And that role models was listed by both. But for women, it was getting a chance to get the opportunity, being supported. It was getting getting the right development, you know, help and support, et cetera. What men listed in terms of reasons why is that women weren't ambitious, that they actually didn't have the technical chops, right, in terms of to do it. It was very different. The reason I share that is it's important for women to make sure that they let the people around them know what it is they want to do. And then they ask the question, if I want to be, make it up, I want to be partner, right, in the firm, I want to be vice president of so-and-so, then ask the question, what do I need to demonstrate, right? What do you need? So have the conversation so it becomes actually an understanding, right? It's okay to ask, and then it's okay to get feedback, and then use that feedback to go forward. So that's one thing that can do in terms of just being intentional, right, about it, in terms of asking for what you want. The other is get mentors and get help. I didn't achieve everything I achieved all by myself. I've had help all along the way. And it's not just help on how you should think about your career. That's what how people mostly think about mentors. No. In order to get to the next step, you've got to ace your current step. And it's rare that you get a job that somebody else has not had. So go talk to them. Start your job on first base because you've learned from somebody else versus starting, you know, on home plate. So those are some simple things you can do in terms of to increase your odds. There's a lot more stuff in the book. But with regards to what companies can do, so realize that sometimes it is harder for women because of imposter syndrome, because of confidence, you know, what have you, to indeed express what it is they want. Ask them, have the conversations. What do you want to do in your career, right? Also, sponsorship is so important. One of the things that I always recommend to companies that I get engaged with is starting at the top. You know, we expect all of our leaders to be developers of future leaders. So as part of that, ask them to sponsor two people that don't look like them. Find two people in the company and then work to help develop them. And their ability to do that shows you whether or not they have the ability to actually develop leaders in the future. So it's a win-win. So those are just a couple of examples, David.
Great, thank you. You know, Matt and Juice, two men have a question about allies and sort of a version of the same question, which is, we've talked a little bit about what companies can do and what women can do. What can the allies of women or the allies of people of color do to help lift others up in the workplace, outside the workplace, and to ensure and advance equality?
Sure. So, you know, one is, I'll call it in meetings. And, you know, every company has their own culture in terms of how meetings operate. But one of the things I hear often from women is they feel they aren't heard in meetings. So one of the things to do is help amplify the voices. When a point is made by a woman that you think is a good point, instead of keeping it to yourself that you think it's a good point, it's like, oh, that's a good point. Actually say it. Or build on it, you know, with credit, you know, in terms of Susan, thanks for saying that. It sparks the idea of such and such and such and such, right? Or that's a good perspective. I actually have a different view, but do something that acknowledges them, right? And their overall participation. So amplify voices helps. Open doors. If you see someone that actually is not actively participating, whether it's a meeting, event, or whatever, and you feel that they definitely should have the capability, just give them the benefit of the doubt, right? Give them space, invite them in. All of those things in terms of can be helpful. The other is just ask them, hey, anything I can do to be helpful? You know, it's not really a lot of magic. It's really, people just want to know they have support.
We're I think 42 minutes into this interview, and I shockingly have not mentioned the word culture. And and that's surprising because at Bridgewater, we talk about culture all the time. We have a very strong and distinctive culture. We think it's a really important part of our community. But the question from Dana is really directed to you, which is, what kind of culture did you aspire to? What kind of culture did you try to build in the company's metrics stream in particular, but all the companies that you led? And did you try to take sort of the same cultural norms from place to place? Or how did you think about culture in the different stages of your career?
Interesting. So every company tends to have their own culture. And so it's learning how to be successful within that culture. So the first time I really had the opportunity to really build my own culture, meaning not participate in someone else's and maybe try to shift or round the edges, but really create my, was at MetricStream. And coming from the learnings of all the other experiences, I was very intentional. I'm sure that surprises you, but I was very intentional about what kind of culture I wanted to create at MetricStream. And it really fell along four areas. And these were the four that we used. So one, which you would expect, which was customer focus. Now, a lot of people say, oh yeah, customer focus. No, no. That meant that we start from the customer. All right. We start from the market. What does the market need? What does it require? Right. We want to fall in love with the market. Because when you're in love with the market, then you want to take care of it. You want to make sure it has everything that it needs, right? You want all the, so that was what that meant when I said customer focus. Second was teamwork. And teamwork doesn't mean we're all nice to each other. What teamwork means is that we can count on each other. You make commitments and you keep commitments. When something's going down, right, people come in. It is, and it's volunteer and proactive. So the teamwork was much more about how we work together, proactive, keep commitments, we can count on each other. And then it was, hang on a minute, customer focus, teamwork, innovation. So the innovation piece, I mean, we're in technology, so of course you expect innovation. But no, when I talk about innovation, I meant everyone. I don't care if you're in finance, HR, you know, whatever. We can always be innovative about how we are accomplishing our overall objectives. So I expected everyone to be bring innovation and interesting approaches and different ways of doing things. And then the fourth and final was never say die. I couldn't come up with a simple word. So it's literally a phrase, never say die. And never say die was just that we are going to figure out how to make it happen, whatever it happens to be, over, under, around, you know, it's the resilience piece. And it, we're not giving up. We are going to figure out how to get it done. So it was really those four things. And frankly, our performance reviews, you know, people do performance reviews and metrics, and it was on those four categories. So the performance review had, okay, customer focus, how are you doing? Teamwork. So it was used for everything on how we evaluated, which is how we continued to hopefully drive that message home. But those were the four elements of our culture.
And how tough a time did you have in finding the right people to fulfill that culture? Did you develop them along the way? Did you have to move some people out and bring in new talent? Like how?
Yes.
How did you do that? How did you balance those?
Sure. So the answer is yes and yes, right? Yes, you tried to find people that you thought fit the culture. Did they always? No. Did you have to move them out? Yes. Did you develop it? The answer is yes. So it was really all of it. What I found was certain things over time, though, you know, customer focus and falling in love, you could develop and you could encourage and you could coach, and absolutely. This thing about teamwork and accountability, right? And being a good partner, you could also develop that one. The innovation, not always. And then the never say die resilience, I found it was there or it wasn't there. That was a much harder one in terms of actually. So it's interesting over time. Therefore, as I would interview and bring people on board, what I always focused on was the resilience piece and the innovation piece.
Uh-huh.
Because we found the other two we could actually develop. But those two, eh.
How did you test for the resilience piece? We had that same toughness or, ability to sort of, you know, deal with challenges and so forth. How did you try to figure that out and test for it?
Believe it or not, it's talking a whole lot about how people grew up. Yeah. I found the best way to find that was in getting the stories about how people grew up. and what they experienced, right? And what happened. That's where I would spend the time. And definitely ask in terms of work as well. You know, what have you had? But so many times people, I mean, you come in prepared for an interview. So those questions, when it comes to professional, you've got canned. Most yeah. people do that are, especially yeah. once you're senior, right? Once you're senior, you've got those. So it's in telling the stories though, when you're young, and I'd spend a lot more time there than most people do. So therefore those aren't canned typically. Yeah. So that's how I would try to figure it out. Now, was I perfect? No, still mishired. I mean, geez.
Yeah.
I wish I could say that, yes, I was 100% on hiring at any point. And the answer is not.
Liz has a question about your intentionality, but expanding it a bit more beyond career. And how did you manage being a mother, being your marriage, all the your self-health, your well-being? How have you managed that throughout your life, and what tips do you have for all of us in terms of thinking about that?
Yes. So I was intentional in that too. And also I talk about that in the book as well. This is not just a business. This is kind of all of it. Cause I'm one person. So I don't know how to separate it. I actually talked to the person who became my husband, but I talked to my husband about my ambitions, about, you know, choices and flexibility, right? And all those things before we even got engaged. So we created.
I mean, you were interviewing him.
Oh, for totally. Listen, you laugh. I literally had, and I do write about this in the book too, but I literally had on graph paper, because I was like 19 when I created it. I had a list of what I needed in a life partner because I wanted a long-term marriage. My parents had a long-term, my family, people have long-term marriages, and I wanted a long-term marriage. So that was my objective, a long-term marriage. So I was looking for a life partner. And I literally made a list of what I thought I needed in a lifetime partner and written down on graph paper. And then when my husband and I got engaged, I gave him my, list. but yeah, so as a result, everything that was on there, we talked about. I'm just a big believer. It's just like at work. I mean, we set expectations at work all the time, right? Or if you're good, you do. I think it's important to have the conversation and understand the expectations kind of going in. So as a result, it was easier for me than it is for some women, because it wasn't that we had to suddenly make decisions every step of the way about who was doing what and how do we do it. And, you know, we came into it saying, all right, we're a team. I want to be a CEO. You're working. I mean, therefore we're going to need to figure out how we do this. I'm not saying it was all easy. It wasn't, but it was easier because we had talked about it and settled on some things. I did not do laundry for 35 years, did not do laundry. Not the only thing I did. Maybe I can think of a few times where if I was walking by the laundry room, you might say, could you put the wet stuff in the dryer? Like, yep, I can do that. That was not my job. We divided and conquered. I didn't load dishwashers. I could come up with all the things that I didn't do. And there were things that he didn't do. But I found that we had to divide it, because if we didn't divide it and one of us kept the responsibility, then we're still keeping it all in our head. Yeah. And it's taking bandwidth that I want to use to focus on other things. So anyway, just as an example, by the way, if you delegate and divide like that, that means I also didn't ask. Or if I saw a bunch of laundry and it wasn't done, did I say, oh, are you going to do the laundry? No, the laundry didn't exist. If I didn't have something to wear, I bought something. Because as soon as you do that, as soon as you make a comment, you complain about how something's washed or folded or hung or what, it's your job again. Right. So you let go completely.
What about the well-being part, both, you know, mental, spiritual, physical, you know, you've been in super intense jobs. We're going through a moment, but we all are, where, you know, there's the different stresses and strains associated with COVID and working from home and uncertainty. What were your lessons there?
Yeah. Well, I'll be candid. And I did talk about this in the book too, but I, in my late 20s, I burned out. I was already married. I had two kids. I'm working hard as we're kind of working up that ladder. I'm trying to get to my first big P&L by the time I'm 30 at IBM, and I'm doing all these different things, and I'm in the community, and I literally burned out to the point where I was depression. I was literally was depressed. And it never happened to me before in my life. I didn't even know what the heck it was. I just was having a hard time getting out of bed, and I was having a hard time, just hard time. So I actually went to see a psychologist because I'm like, I don't know what's wrong with me. And what I learned through that process was I was giving away 100% of myself to everybody else, And I wasn't refilling the tank at all. So what I learned is I need to take care of myself. And I know people say that all the time, but until you actually learn it, you know, give yourself the oxygen before you help the neighbor. It's the same thing. So honestly, what I've always done now, two things are like non-negotiable for me: exercise. And even if I can only get 15 minutes in, you know what I mean? I do something, but exercise. And I eat three meals a day. Now, I know that sounds ridiculous. People are like, of course, everybody eats three meals a day. No, they don't. I eat three healthy meals. It's not a granola bar and an apple or a bag of peanuts, right? Because I, you know, even when I was a CEO, I'd bring my lunch. If I didn't have a lunch meeting, I'd bring it. And the reason I brought it is because you get busy and then you're not eating the right things. So if I can do those two things, then I'm usually okay. And then I have some other things that I do too, but those two are like non-negotiable. So the key is, and I've never had a problem since, but you do absolutely have to figure out what does your body need. And then it becomes non-negotiable that you have to do that for yourself.
And how did your kids, or how did you manage the kid part, and how did they experience, you know, the high-powered mom, CEO, and how did you and your husband, who was also working, balance all that?
Yeah, so, you know, it was always challenging. We had a family calendar, you know, that as soon as we could put it online, we put it online so that everybody could see what the heck was going on. And frankly, Scotty worked up until, I guess, Maryland's, that would have been up until Keaton was probably 5 years old or 6 years old. My son, he's the baby, the youngest one. And then he actually started staying home, because at that point I was on track for what I wanted to do. We were willing to make the trade-offs for one wage earner, and he actually stayed home. Mm-hmm. But before that, it was all about, honestly, calendaring. Who's got what, when, laying it out and getting help, you know? So we had a nanny or au pairs. And let me just talk about that for a minute, because I know people here are different. Financial flexibility. You've got to put your finances and match them with your values and your goals. And a lot of people don't do that either. When Scotty and I got married, we put together our budget, and we wanted kids, and I wanted kids right away. So the first line item of the budget was childcare, because I wanted a nanny, because I'm working and he's working and I have aspirations and I want to be able to give it as much as I can. Well, could we afford a nanny? No. Normally, no, but it was in line number one. And then everything else fit into the rest. We lived in a teeny little place and it was way out. We drove used cars, whereas all my friends were buying new cars because they just got their first job. I mean, we were spending our money here, and date nights for the first 3 years were pizza and a bottle of wine.
And Blockbuster.
Right? And Blockbuster. That's right. That's right. But I mean, you know, it was, all I'm saying is set your goals and then give yourself the financial map so that you can spend the dollars where you need to spend it to be able to support what it is that you're trying to do. Don't lock it all up in fixed expenses and then say, oh man, I don't have any money to do something, because you do have it. You're just choosing not to spend it that way.
Got it.
Anyway, I got on my pedestal.
running out of time here, but I wanted to end the interview on a couple sort of stepping back as, you know, a senior leader in the technology sector and just looking at how quickly the world's changing, in many ways accelerated by the pandemic. And if you look at technology adoption and these big seismic shifts that are coming underway as a result of these emerging technologies, artificial intelligence, quantum science, there's, you know, it feels to me at least like we're at the beginning of a industrial revolution kind of seismic shift. How do you see it? How do you see that playing out? What does it mean for the economy, for the technology sector, yeah, you know, from your perch?
Yeah, I fully agree with you. Especially when you go through what we're going through. I mean, anytime you have a crisis, it tends to accelerate trends that were already underway. And because we have crisis on top of crisis right now, I think it's just opening up a lot of disruption. And is the good news bad news? So what's the good news? The good news is we're going to see some amazing in the next, 3 to 5 years. I think we're going to see some really amazing technological leaps, really beginning to change how we do things. Now, do I have a crystal ball and know exactly what all that is? I don't, but I'm really confident we will see them. The bad news is we're going to end up disrupting and disenfranchising a lot of workers because it will change how work happens. And in changing how work happens, just like during the Industrial Revolution, you end up with a lot of people whose jobs go away. But that's not a permanent go away, because a whole lot of new jobs will be created. They just tend to be different skills and different requirements. So it's going to be a bit tough, I believe, in terms of overall as we do this. But I think right now, I mean, it's a fabulous time to be innovative. When people are going through this kind of crisis, they're willing to try new things. Even if they aren't early adapters, we have grandmothers now that are actually ordering things online that were not online before, yeah. Right? Why? Because they have to. Well, guess what? Everybody right now is opening to do things differently and try new things. So it's a great opportunity for innovative products and approaches and new technology. So it's actually super exciting. And there's a lot of cool things being developed in the startup world. What's actually gonna actually click, that I don't know, but I am super excited between what's going on with telecom, with 5G, and what's happening in technology. All of it's coming together, and we're gonna have just some amazing opportunities.
Okay, so I'm gonna end with you going back to your book. We've got a lot of people on the line here who are early in their careers, who are unapologetically ambitious, who want to do great things. And so, what advice would you have if you think about that changing landscape you just described, lots of disruption, and you look at the opportunity that, great ambitious people have, why don't we end on just a note of advice for those people, and they can get the full download in your book, but what would you suggest to them?
Absolutely. So first, take ownership for your career. Don't leave it up to your boss, the company. Take ownership for your career. And so what does that mean? That means making sure that you are actually continuing to develop skills, right? Capabilities, that you are growing and building your value. And with all these changing things happening, focus on what are the skills that are in demand, right? And build those, because that's what will continue to give you opportunity as you go forward. So own your career, invest in yourself, and then let people know what you want to do. Let people know what your aspirations are so that they can help you.
Shelly, that's a perfect, perfect way to end what's been a great discussion. Really, on behalf of all of us at Bridgewater, I just can't thank you enough for spending time with us. It's, you bring so many interesting perspectives and have succeeded in so many different ways that it's really a pleasure to have a chance to talk to you about it. So thank you on behalf of all of us. We hope you can come for a visit once we get back to normal here.
Indeed. Well, thank you very much, David. And I would love to take you up on that when we're allowed.
Thanks. Have a great day. Good luck with the book launch.
Thank you. And thanks, everyone. I appreciate your questions.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.